listening to Inclusive AF with Jackie Clayton and Katie Van Horn.
I know. That's so easy to find.
That's why we're friends, because we both spell our names differently than most. So
yes.
This is Katie Van Horn.
And this is Jackie Clayton.
And this is the Inclusive AF podcast. And as you heard, and I think most of our listeners know, Jackie and I are weird. We spell our names weird. That's all I can say on this fine Wednesday as we're recording.
It explains a lot.
Now, Jackie, I know we talked yesterday briefly about, tomorrow obviously is Thanksgiving. For those of you who are listening, you're going to hear this after Thanksgiving, but we did have an episode a while back about our favorite Thanksgiving. And so we're going to probably ask our guests to share their favorite Thanksgiving side dish. And we're going to compare notes, because Jackie has the grossest one, even though she thinks mine are the grossest. But
gross.
Have a treat.
I think it's fun because, and one that you find out as you were like got older that, oh, wait, y'all don't do that? Everybody has one of those where it's like, you don't have that on your table?
Yeah, that's not something you, yeah. So anyways, all right, without further ado, we would like to introduce our amazing, amazing guest. Nika White is from Nika White Consulting, and she is joining us this morning to have a conversation, and we're so excited to have you. So Nika, would you like to introduce yourself?
I would love to. Listen, y'all, I am on Inclusive AF podcast. That is a joy. That is a highlight for me this week. And so I'm so grateful. While it's the week of Thanksgiving, I'm grateful to be able to have that opportunity to share space with both you, Katie, and Jackie. So thank you so much for inviting me on. I'm Dr. Nika White. My pronouns are she, her, hers. And I have the honor and privilege of serving as founder and lead principal consultant of a full service diversity, equity, and inclusion boutique consultancy under my brand name. And specifically, we are full service. We intersect the work of diversity, equity, and inclusion of belonging with leadership and business, working with all types of clients, different industries, different sectors, helping them to integrate into their business framework, strategic diversity, intentional inclusion, and a lens of equity. And so I am so happy to be here and look forward to digging in.
I love that. We were talking earlier. Some people don't know that we were part of a mastermind group, and you always had such great insight, and we used to share, and I'm glad that we can share you with our millions of fans. Millions.
Yeah, I'm definitely the beneficiary of being a part of this experience today. So grateful.
So, we started chatting, and then I, of course, had to say, wait, we have to record this first. So let's jump right in, because I think, we're at a place in time, and Nika, you brought this up about, we know that there's probably an economic downturn happening. And what does that mean for the state of, consultants and the practice of, focusing on diversity, equity, and inclusion for organizations? We've just recently got to the place where corporations understand that a budget needs to be allocated for this work. So what are your thoughts?
What are my thoughts? I have so many. First and foremost, I guess I have to take a step back and reflect on 2020, when after the murder of George Floyd, how there was this heightened sense of awareness and appetite to have the conversation, to begin to engage in the work that maybe many organizations were sitting on the fence about, feeling as though that's not a part of our charge and our mission, right? We're going to stay in our lane. But they realized that they could no longer be complicit about it, because if they were perceiving that their employees, who are part of the Black and Brown communities, were not deeply impacted by what was happening outside of the four walls of the organization, they were misguided, and they were correct. And so they were right to want to engage and to want to initiate the work of DEIB with a deepened level of commitment. So I start there, because there was this groundswell of support for the work that I think completely helped all of us who care deeply in this space as practitioners and leaders to feel hopeful, right? And then as time went on, we started to see some of those heightened sentiments around, yes, we got to do this. We have to do it in a really effective way that can be sustained, that started to also wane, right? And it became very performative. And so Fast forward now that we have gone through the pandemic, of course, we've gone through the situation of, you know, the 2020, and now there's all this talk of, you know, headwinds around economic downturn. It's disheartening in some ways because we feel like we can't catch a break. You know, can we just be on this path, this consistent path of being able to really make significant change that can be sustained? And it feels like we get derailed. And so I share that because what I am holding in mind is, as you mentioned, Katie, there are many organizations that are just kind of coming to the table and the realization that this work is important. And so what will this recession do to those leaders and those decision makers who are having to make some really tough decisions? I don't want to minimize the decision-making process because as a founder and leader myself of a business, I know that you have to think about a lot of different things. But I am concerned about that. I'm concerned that just first and foremost, from a general consultancy perspective, that is considered kind of a luxury for many organizations, right? We want to get a subject matter expert to kind of help us navigate this work. And so if it's considered a luxury and a premium, then what happens when you're in a recession? You kind of cut those premiums, right? And then I also think about the explicit work of DEIB. And so when you combine consultancy the way that I just described it, along with thinking about it in the context of DEIB and how people are just kind of coming to see it as important. And so maybe, you know, it's easy for them to revert back to seeing it as less important. What is that going to do? I'm curious about what others are experiencing, but I can tell you that as a founder in this space, we are experiencing some differences and some changes. We're seeing the sales process being expanded. People are taking much longer to close deals. What that means to me is either they're trying to hold out because they are concerned as well, and they're planning and strategizing. You know, everybody's in the war room right now. Or perhaps this is them, you know, communicating that we're just waiting to see if we're going to have something left, which means it's kind of now secondary, right? After we've satisfied some of the other things that we have prioritized. And so, yeah, that's what I'm experiencing. And I'm really interested to see what you all are hearing and experiencing as well.
I can tell you, I've seen some of that at Textio and looking at clients of some people pulling back. But some have been doubling down on it because they know they don't want to lose. As we're at the same time, we're still having people, the great reshuffle, whatever you want to call it. People are still quitting. I feel like, and there's been some fear of, I've seen other organizations saying, we can't lose this because we recognize that the retention and we've been able to start seeing the sparks of innovation because of these diverse teams. And we can't do both. We can't be the company that laid everybody off and the company, unless you're Elon Musk, the company that shut down ERGs and have a layoff, right? Other people are being more conscious because they recognize what's happening is you see there's organizations that are still hiring, kind of like what we saw during COVID, all of these companies that you were like, whoa, I didn't know there was a need. And so there are still organizations that will, like every recession, that are profiting during this time. And so I think it might be, in some instances, depending on where you are, it might be better for consultants. I feel like they will let go of permanent employees and opt for consultants to come in as needed to build that program, even though it could be expensive, but they have it, right? And maybe they offer it to HR to present or different things. But I don't see it as much as I've seen it in the past, where it was the first thing getting cut. If you look at layoffs.fyi and look at the lists of the titles of people that have been laid off, I've been shocked because I'm seeing recruiters are always going to, I mean, sorry, boo, but so recruiters have been laid off, but I've been seeing software engineers, salespeople, and I wonder how much really needed to do the layoff or similarly to the beginning of the pandemic, people that are saying, oh, well, everybody's laying off. People will give us a break. We'll just lay off now and see what happens.
Yeah. So what's coming up for me, Jackie, and I just want to touch on what you just shared, is that I think that you're right. there are going to be some organizations who are going to lean more into this because they will say, we've gained too much traction and momentum. We don't want to lose that because it's almost like just taking the investment that's been made and just, you know, counseling it out. We don't want to do that. But what I am concerned about is that even if organizations who buy into the fact that we need to keep this in place and they don't eliminate the roles and the function, will the capital that needs to be leveraged to help fund some of the initiatives yep. still be there? And we know that we already find ourselves having lots of conversations about how many times those who are charged with doing the work are under-resourced, right? And so what are the implications of that, even if they do keep the role intact, right? Katie, I would love to hear your thoughts too.
Yeah, I think you both are spot on. And the other piece that I'm seeing and kind of hearing from folks in this space is around the what type of engagements mm-hmm. they're getting yeah. asked to do. So there are some groups that it's going back to the, oh, we just need you to come in and speak about something, or we just need you yeah. to, can you just do unconscious bias training? And I'm like, no, like we're not going back, kids, like come on forward, like let's keep moving the train. But I also think that there are some folks that are running scared right now. And what I mean by that is companies are seeing the impact and seeing the value of having a diverse team. As Jackie just mentioned, that innovation that's happening. Mm-hmm. And I think it's like, oh, wait, this actually works. And so I think there is, you know, a subset of folks that is running scared, and it's still that same clamoring of, if I'm a white male, I feel like I'm somehow not in the mix anymore. But that's never been the case. And that's never been what any person I know of in the DEI space has said. We need everyone at the table. And, you know, so it's one of those things that it's the, how do we think about this in a different way? And how do we shift people's thinking about this to truly actionable work? And I think that's where we see the impacts. And I mean, you both know the impacts that can be made even in a short period of time, but mm-hmm. given a 3-year plan or a 5-year plan, the amount of impact you can make. And so I'm reassured that companies are still thinking about this. And to Jackie's point, it's not the first thing that's getting cut. And I'm not saying it's not at some point, like you said, you know, that it might be something they have to do from a business imperative, but I'm hopeful, I guess is the best way that I can put it, that folks are seeing the impact and seeing what good this can be and want to keep the momentum.
Yeah. I think it is bizarre right now. Like, I mean, why are we talking about a potential recession when the freaking interest rates for housing is like 7%? Like, what do you mean? Like, yeah. what signs do you need? Like, people aren't making money. What else? What are you waiting for? Is it like the Groundhog's Day? Like, there's an official wizard that comes out and says, yes. Officially a recession.
Well, here's what I'm seeing though. There are a lot of astute business leaders and organizational leaders who are in the war room now, being proactive to plan for it, which I think is always smart. And those are usually the ones who are going to come out on top, right? You know, you don't need to wait and be reactionary. You need to make sure you're being proactive. So in that level of proactivity, there may be having to decrease their rates. They may be having to cut expenses, you know. But I think that prioritization and that exercise is important. I do encourage that across all organizations. We're in the midst of doing it right now for my firm. I just want people to be thoughtful about how in which they're making those decisions. You know, it's interesting. I heard someone say the other day, as they were talking about this same thing, that a white male CEO had shared, there's no way I'm going to cut DEI because as a white male CEO, that's going to send a completely different message that I don't want out there in the marketplace. So whatever we do, we have to protect it at all costs. And, you know, some kind of felt like, well, is that really the right approach to this? you know, because you have to be able to make good business decisions looking across all areas. And so just to completely say this needs to be protected by all costs, some took issue with that. But what I also appreciated is the self-awareness of, yes, how now people do react and criticize and scrutinize those decisions that organizations are making, you know. So it's an important dynamic for us to begin at least trying to understand how we would navigate it. Yeah.
How are the conversations? Because you have an interesting perspective in that, like, I've gone from like talking to various clients to having one client, and I worked there at this point. So I'm out of the consultancy piece. Mm-hmm. Katie did that too. So you are seeing things, like I would say, we're in our own bubble. So you are seeing things out there, and I'm wondering, what are people saying besides, like, even though we recognize people need to save costs, there is choices in that. So have you heard anything about the why is it not necessary outside of, is it just cost? Or I can't imagine what that conversation would sound like.
Well, again, we have to realize that for so long, many organizations were not even playing in this space at all. So, and by, you know, the perception of many of those individuals, okay, not all is lost. I mean, yes, is this an opportunity for us to get better? There's lots of opportunities, but are we at a place to where everything that we're doing is null and void because we're aren't intentional about DEI? And so when you consider that, you realize that you were able to survive. And in some regards, there are a lot of people that are saying, not only were we able to survive, we were thriving. You know, mm-hmm. we didn't have a whole lot of issues before we, you know, started investing now in this work because we saw it as an opportunity. So then that sends the message, well, okay, again, it's a premium. We can't operate without it, right? And so I think it's the realization of that. And again, I said before that I don't want to undermine the decision-making process and how difficult that can be. When you're having to look across the board at all different competing priorities, it does become a challenge. It becomes really, really hard sometimes. And so I think that's what's coming up. I can tell you what I'm seeing, and also what NWC is doing, is whereas before we've been really solely focused on DEIB, but our approach to DEIB has always been, this is leadership, right? Now we are shifting that, and we are more so amplifying our consultancy around organizational effectiveness and leadership, but it's done with a very specific lens of ensuring that DEI is incorporated. And so, and I feel like that is a direction that may help to resolve some of the anxieties or trepidations that some leaders could be having about, you know, the value very explicitly on DEI. But they can value, we need to have people managers that are well equipped to lead a team, right? And so what does that look like, you know? Because some organizations are even seeing professional development during this weathering of the storm as a luxury. And we know that a lot of the DEI, you know, exposure work, awareness work, the learning experiences, all that's part of professional development. But if you can attack it in a way to where it is addressing maybe both of these very specific needs of interest, like, you know, the leadership development piece, as well as, you know, doing it with the lens of DEI, I think that it has the ability to withstand the test of time.
Yeah, I think that's the piece. And you mentioned a couple things, and you mentioned something at the top of this as well, that, you know, I think companies are seeing why it's important. Companies are seeing what they can benefit, how they can benefit. And it is hard to be in that room making those decisions of yes or no. But I also, I just want to reiterate, and, you know, most of the folks that are listening to us are in HR or are in leadership roles, and knowing the impact that this can make long term and what this will do for your organization, there is a bit of, you can start to become more recession proof if you are using diverse folks on your team to bring those ideas, bring those innovations to the table. Because they will come up with things that you hadn't thought about. Like Jackie, you mentioned, you know, companies pivoting to new things and how do we do this? You know, I mean, I think the one that I always think of anytime I think of the COVID pandemic is the pick up groceries and the grocery delivery right. and how that boom like just happened. And I think that's such a critical thing that it's also having people at the table that are going to go, have we thought about this? Have we thought about that? And I think that's just something that we need to keep in mind is that you're going to drive more innovation. And we iterate that over and over again of how critical that innovation can be for your organization. I want to shift gears a little bit because obviously we did just recently have, and I just saw the news that there was another one this morning.
Yes.
So I want to talk a little bit about Club Q and the LGBTQ community. And I don't even know what to say. I don't even know what to say. And then there was just another shooting this morning. An employee walked into a Walmart in
Virginia, I believe, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I don't even know how to open this conversation because I don't know how to make it stop. What are your thoughts?
It's sickening. It's disheartening. It's I don't know how else to express it. You know, I share it with my team this week as we're going to be off for the Thanksgiving holiday, of course, tomorrow and then Friday. And I share it with them that as I prepare to convene with family and to be around this Thanksgiving table, you know, giving thanks and showing appreciation and fellowshipping with love, I can't help but to be reflective on what kind of words can I find that are adequate enough to provide a level of support to my cousin and her wife, who are going to be a part of this family experience, that's going to allow them to feel safe. I don't think there's anything really we can say or do, but how do we still show forth a level of support, kindness, care, compassion, and just let them know that this is not okay, right? You know, they deserve to feel safe and supported and in all spaces at all times. And so I don't know. I'm at a loss of words in many regards because I feel like this is such commonplace these days that it just doesn't feel adequate to be able to just say, you know, again, my hearts and prayers, my thoughts are with the families. I want to see it stop. And you know, there's a lot to be said about gun control and reform. I know that that hasn't fully found its way to a level of maturity to where we can stop seeing these headlines. And so I think that's also a part of it. I think the fact that we, you know, just had the midterm kind of elections is in some regards playing a role in what we're seeing in the media day in and day out. It's just disheartening. I don't know what else to say about it, to be honest with you.
We are gathered here today to give you permission to plan the wedding that you want.
I'm Jessica Bishop.
And I'm Sari Wienerman.
And we're the hosts of the Bouquet Toss podcast.
Today's couples have to juggle so many things, from family expectations to outdated traditions and what's currently trending.
So to make it easier, we're going deep to figure out why we do weddings the way that we do, so you can decide what to keep and what to toss from your wedding day plans.
You are cordially invited to subscribe to the Bouquet Toss wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcast.com.
By the power vested in us, we pronounce you free to plan your day your way.
I agree with you with all of it that you are saying. And the thing that's also that we have to remember, and I always end up going back to like CRT, like I always go back of like why it's important to understand the history, because I don't think that within the United States that people know that mass shootings are uniquely American. Mm-hmm. That it has become commonplace, and it's known throughout the world. I remember a couple years back, we had an exchange student from Germany, and I was so excited, and I was like asking if they had any questions, and they were like, "Am I in danger of being shot?" You know, because I live in Texas and the United States. And I feel like it's like similarly to the work that we're doing internally, where it's like, I can't turn a blind eye anymore at my office at the things that we've overlooked in the name of capitalism. We can't do that as a country. And so that's another reason why it's so important to bring people into the fold who may have been left off the table to see their leadership opportunities, to then go out and become leaders in our community and know that they have a voice. And I think that's part of it. And like, PS, look around, everybody's jumping into the game. You're like, oh, so you used to sell candles and now you're in charge of the Railroad Commission with oil and gas and coal. Awesome. There's room and spaces, but I think it starts with us making sure that voices are heard and they're getting those leadership opportunities so that we can make choices that are better for all of us and not just the few.
Do you love news about LinkedIn, Indeed, Google, and just about every other recruitment tech company out there?
Hell yeah. I'm Chad.
I'm Cheese.
We're the Chad and Cheese Podcast.
All the latest recruiting news and insights are on our show.
Dripping in snark and attitude.
Subscribe today wherever you listen to your podcasts. We out.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we're preparing a statement for our team members, and you know, and it is the, you can't send these emails out fast enough. Because another thing happens. And it's also the, what do you acknowledge? What do you not acknowledge? What do you talk about? What do you not talk about? And most importantly, and this is the one, and I know we've talked about this before, is how do you support the team members? And this can go for the shooting of unarmed Black people. This can go for the shooting at, you know, at Pulse, at now Club Q, at Walmart, at church. No place is safe, and no group that has historically been marginalized is safe anywhere. And how do you reassure your team members and give them the tools to feel safe and be safe when you can't guarantee that for them?
Absolutely. And I don't think there's an answer to that. I think that the reality is, to your point, Katie, we can't guarantee that, but I still think there's a huge leadership opportunity and the acknowledgement of the pain and the lack of feeling safe. That's so important because it is impacting how people are showing up to the workplace. And so if employers aren't taking the opportunity to have their people leaders to make sure that they're checking in, that they're being a listening ear, not trying to solve it, because not one individual, not one organization is going to be able to solve this issue. I mean, it's too big. It's bigger than all of us collectively. But I think that where the tension points or creating a lot of challenges for people is when they feel like there's this sense of apathy or just unawareness and lack of care and concern. And you're right. I mean, I think I've heard a lot of my clients will say, you know, honestly, we want to make sure that we are, you know, vocalizing and denouncing these acts, but it feels like we could be sending out messages every week, right?
Yeah.
And then does that come disingenuous? You know, does it feel too routine and performative? And so I think that at least for NWC, part of how we like to support clients and during moments like this is to just be that resource of helping them to have resources to arm their people with so that they can be educated, be aware, and to give them a bit more agency and comfort of at least being able to hold space and have a conversation, right? Because I think that's really important.
It's another like reason why you can't get rid of all of your DEIB professionals, because people are like, how do we do it in this moment? I mean, we had a healing circle. We started doing healing circles, and the things that have come out of these healing circles have been surprising. And what people are sharing and the way that it works, people share and you don't respond. This is not a debate. It's for you to feel like you've been heard and set those premises around it. But you have understanding diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging is a leadership trait that you have to have.
Absolutely.
Because you are not, again, you can't turn a blind eye and pretend that that didn't happen. And I remember as I was working on our DEIB report, I was talking to my boss. When I get embarrassed because I might have acted out, I have to say my boss and not their name, even though most people know who my boss is. I was like, it was before the midterms, and I was like, you know, none of this even matters because of what's about to happen, and I don't really care. Like, I don't live in Seattle. I live in Texas, and I'm scared to death every day of what's going to happen here. And that's why it's important not only to understand, you know, you want to have DEIB, but then understand what's going on in the world before you start going and saying, where's that report, or why is this happening, and what has come out with the Inclusion Council and the addition of the Healing Circles is people are feeling, this is something that I didn't realize was going to be the key. Like, everyone wants to participate in all of the DEIB things because it feels like that's the place where they belong. It's become water cooler conversation where everybody is welcome, where they don't have that in any other space, not at the all company meetings, not at their team meetings, but this is a place where we are coming together as humans.
And I think part of the value of those healing circles and those brave space sharing for people to process together is when it is well facilitated, where there are some community agreements to help guide, you know, those discussions, because I think that's important as well. We have seen, we support a lot of clients and those types of endeavors, but we have seen where a lot of harm has occurred because it was not well orchestrated. It was, let's just kind of get into a room and everybody just kind of talk.
Yeah, no.
And while on the surface, it seems like, yeah, this is a great idea. We're going to get people to kind of open up. It is incredibly triggering. And if you aren't well equipped to be able to center those conversations in a way that feels productive and helpful, then it can have an adverse effect. And so I'm a big fan of them, but I'm also a big, you know, advocate of doing them well with facilitators that are trained to be able to hold space in a way that makes the most sense. And so, I mean, you know, and I think that sometimes organizations are really well intended. They want to be able to provide some type of outlet. And so it just seems like the natural thing to just go and do it, or to just, you know, pick anyone to help lead those conversations. But I do often caution that, you know, certainly if they aren't done well, it could have an adverse effect. Yeah.
You're so right. And one of the things that we started adding is some themes that might be part of this conversation for you to make a decision that's best for you. Like when we had our healing circle around Roe v. Wade, without speaking to everyone, we had to let people know that part of the conversation could be around incest, sexual assault, statutory, like all of these things that could be coming into the conversation. Be aware of that before you get there. And then we had meditation at the end of it, and a centering poem is, which is totally that. My DEIB program manager. He's like so great. I would have never thought, because it's like a personal form of torture to be for me. meditation is not my strong suit, but I was like, but it's so nice. But it's funny how organizations react, as you know, with this work. They're like, why can't we just have one? We're like, no, we need to research. We need to bring someone in. We want to talk to some experts. We want to have the format. We've created the rules, the tenets in a PowerPoint that we're about to publish that we're using. We're publishing it for other people because, to That's your point, idea. Do not walk into the room and say, let's talk about mass shootings, because you have to talk about things that happen in the political life, but not make it political inside in those conversations.
Absolutely.
Or else someone's not feeling safe. And based on the midterms, not everybody in the room is going to be thinking in the same way.
Yeah, no, I love the fact that you all had a healing circle around Roe versus Wade. And so again, you know, that is pretty innovative, because not a lot of organizations, I'm sure, incorporated or offered such a space and outlet for people to share. And that's important. One of the things that I often incorporate as a community agreement and just to manage expectations is that accept and expect non-closure, because I think that sometimes yes. people will enter those spaces feeling like, yes, this is going to really heal me. You know, this is going to completely eliminate, you know, any type of trepidation and trauma that I'm feeling and that I'm holding. And it's not, you know, that is a journey. That is a process. But, you know, coming to those conversations, knowing that it if it's done well, it should help create some type of I guess progress, right? And really assessing and dealing and navigating emotions and experiences, but it's not going to give you full non-closure. There's more work to be done, you know. And so there's something to be said about one and done opportunities that I believe you know, we need to more properly manage people's expectations around. Yeah.
I love that you just said that, because I think that is absolutely one of the major tenets, one of the major, you know, conversations that need to occur is this is not going to fix it. Yeah. We're not going to have all the answers by the end of this hour or whatever it is that you dedicate to having the conversation. And that's so critical for folks to know, like, just, it's not, you know, we aren't solving any of these problems right now. We all know that. I mean, there's probably five or six we can name off the top of our head that it's not a one and done conversation. There's a lot of complications to it. There's a lot of pieces to it. And so it is just, you know, being accepting of that and understanding that it's not going to be fixed in an hour or whatever it might be, I think is just something for everyone to be thoughtful about and realize. Right. So I'm going to go back to, you know, I always want to caveat this. So this is not a sales pitch, but I want to reiterate something that you both just said, and that's having an expert in the room to have these conversations. And, you know, you both know me, and there are some conversations that I'm not comfortable facilitating because I am a white woman. Like it would not be appropriate for me to be the person facilitating this. And Jackie's heard this example before, that after Charlottesville, when I was at my prior employer, they had a white male lead a conversation about what happened in Charlottesville. And I strongly, strongly objected. No, this person has experience in trauma. They have, you know, all this. And I was like, that's lovely. I'm sure that they're a wonderful person. They're not the right person for this. And it fell apart in such a horrible way. And it caused more trauma. And then we had to bring in someone who was the right person. And I was happy that we were able to do that. But I think that's the other piece to consider, is that you are talking about stuff that is very personal to people and is very important to people. And having that right facilitator, I cannot, you know, say that enough. Because you can't just be like, oh, I'm in HR, so I can just go and have these conversations. Absolutely not. Because if you do that and it goes sideways, you're causing more trauma, more pain. And that's not ever what, you know, you would want to do. And, you know, of course, no one is going into there trying to do that. But just being aware of that having the right professional person to lead those conversations is just critical. So yeah.
The messenger is important. Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm glad that you said that, and having the understanding of, like, I feel like sometimes in the diversity space, we know that our job is never going to be done 100%. There's always going to be that work. We've gotten used to that understanding. And I think it's easy to forget that other people in this day and age want an instant solution, an outline and a fix. I remember presenting a plan, business plan, and all the various steps for the diversity framework. And they're like, well, when are we done? I was like, we're not going to be done. And then like, when do we get to stage 4D, then what we do? I was like, you go back to 1A and right. then we go through it again. And I think it's good to have a friendly reminder of what the goals are when you have these things, but recognizing that what we don't want, especially with people having hybrid and remote workspaces, for people to have feel like they're in this alone, and be able to know that we are paying attention and trying to make sure that we're taking care of all of our employees and reminding them of the resources that we have internally, of the experts.
The question of when we're done is so short-sighted and incredibly misguided. And I get lots of those questions too. I mean, in fact, I am recalling a conversation with a white male leader, C-suite leader in one of the clients' organizations that we're partnering with. And it was a really genuine question, but his question was, this was after we did a deep dive assessment and we kind of presented all the information, and he was really trying to defend his perception. And I was like, well, where you sit in our organization certainly determines what you see, right? Which is why if you do this deep dive assessment, you need to hear from those that are probably not in the seat that you're in. But and then he really honestly just said, I know I have a lot to learn, but I'm just really curious, when is enough enough? Feels like we're doing all the things. When is enough enough? And he really, really was genuinely curious about that. And so it was a similar answer. You know, there's not a we're done. There's no such thing, you know. And I think also just reminding people that there's not an expectation to boil the ocean, right? You know, I think that being intentional about incremental, you know, wins and goals along the way, and then letting that serve as the momentum and the traction to go after loftier goals. But once you've kind of reached a certain point, that doesn't mean it's the end. That's just that point. You're just at that guard post. Then hopefully you begin to do the hard work of now assessing what's next for us and how do we implement change to tackle those other deeper issues and opportunities. And so, yeah, when is enough enough? It's not. Yeah.
Right. And you're so right. You're so smart. And you're making me think of, it would be good for us and some of our cohorts to put together like the must have skills in order to do this work. Understanding of change management is so important, or understanding and having other people, because a lot of what we saw, going back full circle to where we started the conversation, going back to 2020, going back to the death of George Floyd, where a lot of people were ill-prepared to take the role of DEIB consultant, program manager, ERG leader, didn't recognize, because you wouldn't have the ability to recognize, because all of us know the way we went into this work is not where we are today.
Right. Right. I tell people all the time that it takes both will and skill. I love the passion. Passion does have value, but passion ain't gonna get you but so far.
That's right.
And so how are we upskilling ourselves and other individuals who we are charging this role and this responsibility to? Which first and foremost, it starts with recognizing that no one person can own that role. It belongs to all of us. But for those who is physically built into their like job description, or literally built into their job description, then yes, how well have you equipped them, and are you upskilling them to be able to really lead this charge where they're thinking about it day in and day out, and they are creating the change that is needed, that transformative DEI change that is needed, and not just kind of solving for it with an activity. You know, activity has a start and an end date.
That's right.
We're looking at impact. How do we look at systems, policies, procedures, culture, right? We need to get to the crux of the matter and stop being surface with this work. And so I have a lot of energy around helping people to realize that, to your point, Jackie, yes, in 2020, we had lots of experts that just popped up overnight, right? And I love the fact that there's greater level of energy and passion and interest in this space and this discipline. But I also want to make sure that we are being very thoughtful about what kind of message we're sending if we really are taking the responsibility of ensuring we are well equipped, or even that we are well equipping those who we are charging with this responsibility. Yeah.
Yes, because a lot of times, these people are othered people. They picked black or brown people, a lot of times women, to come in, and now it can cause major harm. You're perpetuating the same trauma that you're purporting to solve by putting people in this role. And it just, and again, to your point, passion is great, but understanding DEIB from a business perspective, and a biz is completely different. Because I'm like, if you're talking about, you know, outside and I'm walking down the street, I'm looking for things that are going to help me, my family, my friends, my circle. But in a professional world, I understand how we have to do this without being disruptive. Externally, I want to be disruptive. Outside of work, inside of work, I recognize that. So
yes, we have to move strategically. That's another thing. I love the fact that you just said externally, I can be disruptive, but internally, there is a goal that I have my mind set on, right? And I have to be strategic. And that means even trying to regulate and manage our emotions as people that care deeply about this work. You know, yes, we can kick, scream, and holler, and we can shame, guilt, and blame, but where is that going to get us, right?
That's right.
You know, we need to make sure that we are not allowing our level of aggression, which sometimes is rightful. So I don't want to minimize those feelings because, again, many of us that are in this space are people that are part of those marginalized communities that are very much impacted, you know, disproportionately impacted. But I think that we have to also make sure that we realize that because we chose this work and for us, that there's a certain level of appetite that we must show up with that allows us to keep our eyes on the prize.
Yes,
and I am quoting Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But yes, on that prize is that change. We can't change hearts and minds if we are attacking people, right? That level of aggression will be met with aggression. The conversation ends. There's no rapport. There's no trust. And then where does that get us, you know?
Yes. Yeah. And you can't say you big dummy, because there's so many times that I want to say that on a weekly basis.
Yes, you and I both. Well, yes, can't say that.
I think it goes to another piece, and there's two things I want to mention. And, you know, one of them, obviously, being the HR weirdo that I am, you know, there's some legal aspects that I think need to come up when people are talking about some of these topics, that what you can and cannot do, what you should and should not do, all of those things. But I think there's also this, you know, how do we make sure that whoever is doing this work, I love the point of you're not re-traumatizing them by making them do the work, making sure you're actually giving them the resources to do what's right. But then I think there's also another piece to this that's the, you're never done, but also everyone's at a different place in their journey.
Right.
And I think that's one that's also really hard. And especially, I mean, it is the, there are times when you want to say, oh my God, just get on board the train. Like, it's not that difficult. It is 2022. Yeah. Come on down.
Yeah.
And I think that comes up so much as well, that every time we start engaging with a new organization, every time someone joins that organization, you have to go back to zero and have to go back to, okay, how, where are we right now? Mm-hmm. Or, hey, this is what we've already done. I need you to catch up. And that's the other piece. So yeah.
I agree. And one of the tension points that I often bring to the attention of a lot of the client partners that we work with is that, especially when you start this journey, get prepared to have a camp of two sets of individuals. You're going to have a group that's going to be, we're not aggressive enough, we're not pushing hard enough, we're not assertive enough, we need to, you know, do this in this certain way and do it by this timing. Those folks are a bit further along and they want to see that change happen with greater level of urgency. Then you also have, well, we want to make sure that we are bringing people along in a way that allows them to feel comfortable and engaging, and we're moving too fast. We need to slow walk this. Managing those tension points is one of the most challenging things that I often have client partners to brace themselves for. Because if you aren't prepared for that, then you could get frustrated really easy and feel like, well, we can't please everybody. So what are we supposed to do here? You have this camp saying this, this camp saying that. But I think it's about not just realizing that there's a one size fits all approach, but being so strategic in how in which we're solving for this, that we take into account the diversity of all of the people that we're trying to bring along, right? They have different mental models. They're entering the conversations at different points within their learning journey. They have different expectations. And so that's why when I often will recommend and talk about these, you know, DEI learning and development experiences, and I use that word very intentionally because I don't really believe in than training. Training sounds like a destination, a one and done. We need experiences that take into account a series of different modalities, because people learn in different ways. You know, it could be a combination of books and films and, you know, deep dive, you know, learning circles or more of the formal kind of knowledge exchange. But so many different ways in which we need to be considering ways to bring people along. And that's how you manage those tension points instead of just saying, this is the one way. I'm not even a fan of like mandatory DEI training, unless it's something that, you know, from a legal perspective, you know, organizations, you feel like they have to protect themselves by saying we did provide this information. But even in that regard, I'm often challenging organizations to think creatively about how can we strongly encourage, and we can, you know, put some tactics in place and strategies to make sure that we are modeling the behaviors that we want from people in terms of engagement, so that people don't show up, you know, doing the work in spite of, but they do it because of, because they really truly believe it and believe in the value of it. So, well, yeah.
If you make it required, we don't know who to fire. Like, if you make it required, we don't know where to start with the problem. By not making it, we'll be like, ooh, you know, Jeff has not been to one, has not signed up for one. We might need to speak to Jeff.
What's going on with Jeff?
But something that Katie brought up, and this is like a horrible segue, but something that Katie brought up was saying that we're all in different places. And so because of that, we all have a different belief system. And a lot of this started in childhood, that we don't recognize that this is formulated before we even started school, our ideas of the interpersonal relationships, how I see myself and I identify, which unironically has very much to talk about Thanksgiving and the things that we were having and why these things were very odd. Because I will tell you, there's two, Katie makes fun of me for one thing in particular, but number one, I think we should talk about the things that we have at Thanksgiving that people think are maybe odd, or share some of those things, and or traditional meals. And number one is we eat sauerkraut on Thanksgiving.
No.
Now listen.
New Year's
my Day. Listen, which is dumb because that's gross. No black eyed peas. So we eat sauerkraut. My family is from Baltimore. Baltimore was founded by, you should know this, German Katie, people from Germany. And so that's why we eat sauerkraut. Now, the other thing that I make that Katie thinks sounds disgusting is I made it because my husband's family, they made it. And I was like, oh, I'll try it. It is broccoli casserole, air quotes around casserole, because it's broccoli and Velveeta, like 2 pounds of broccoli, a whole of the big industrial of Velveeta, Ritz crackers with butter on top, and then you bake it.
Yeah.
Delish. But listen, that's what we have. And I mean, we have the regular things, collard greens, dressing, whatever. But these are the things that are very distinctively, I buy sauerkraut during Thanksgiving, and it usually stays there until the next Thanksgiving. And I think I should throw it away, and I buy a new jar of sauerkraut. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have to say, I don't think I've ever heard of a tradition of having sauerkraut for Thanksgiving. So that is interesting to me. But the broccoli casserole.
Thank you, Nika.
But in Jackie's defense, the broccoli casserole, that sounds pretty commonplace for me. I think a lot of families will do a broccoli casserole or a green bean casserole.
Like on the box of Ritz crackers, right? Because what other ingredient? You use two sleeves. It's half the box of Ritz crackers.
And I think I just had this conversation. I don't even know if it was you, Jackie, or who I was talking to about going back to like the Betty Crocker cookbook.
Me. We were talking about doing it. Yeah.
And like some of the stuff, some of the recipes that are in there that you're like, why? And it's the same thing. So Nika, what are you cooking tomorrow? Or if you're going somewhere, what's the meal tomorrow for you?
So it's going to be all of the traditional stuff. We don't really deviate, to be honest with you, but I will tell you, I can share my favorite that I always look forward to, and that is my aunt's collard greens. I mean, they are amazing. She It has a certain sweetness to it, which I think is a little unique. It's not a lot of people will sweeten their greens, but it has great sweetness to it. But then it's also the way that she prepares it in terms of like all these different types of peppers and jalapeno. It just gives it a great kind of mix and blend. And so it's always my favorite. We always say make tons and tons and tons of collard greens because it's everyone's favorite. So
yeah. And we come, like, I feel like,
remind me, where are you based? Because we're on our way.
Yeah. I mean, we might need that recipe.
I'm actually based in Greenville, South Carolina. And so my sister actually lives in DC. And so she's not far from you, Jackie. And so she'll be getting in town later today. But yeah, it's very traditional. And you know, yeah, I do hear of a lot of like families that will do something a little different, like maybe like a Charleston broil for those who know about the Charleston broil, and we don't do that, but there are a lot of families who do. And I think it's because maybe Thanksgiving and Christmas are so close that they kind of feel like we don't want to have the same type of meals. But I don't know. I love the traditional aspect of knowing I can have turkey and macaroni and cheese and ham and potato salad and collard greens on Thanksgiving Day. No.
That's awesome. Yeah. Perfect. So we are way over time because we love talking.
We do that.
I try to keep us on time, but never works. Anyways, what is one thing you want to make sure our listeners hear, think about, reflect on, go research as we kind of leave this episode?
Yeah, I love this question, Katie and Jackie. And I have to go back to kind of where we started with the conversation, which is the importance of impressing upon all those key decision makers to realize that while we know tough decisions are going to be upon many of us, right? We don't at all want to negate that. But I do want people to be very thoughtful about the consequences of not continuing to support the DEI work in really meaningful ways. Because whether or not you are connecting to dots to the output of the organization to DEI, you know, research has time and time again proven that there's direct correlation. And so the more that I think we can lean into allowing people to have that sense of belonging and showing up at their best, then we're going to be able to weather the storm, you know, in a way that I think will serve us all well. And so just think twice, have conversations, very meaningful conversations with lots of different stakeholders who are going to be directly impacted, so that at least, you know, there's some inclusive decision making going on as you are really forced to think intently about how and which to prioritize the investment of dollars. Leave DEI in.
Awesome.
I can listen to like Nika speak. You just something about, I don't know what that is. I'm just like, I just want to listen to everything you said. Like, yeah, say more.
Well, you too. This is our 8-hour Thanksgiving episode.
You two make it so easy. Again, I feel like I am such a beneficiary of being able to share this space and time. And so thank you for the opportunity. Aww. And I certainly, you know, hope this won't be the last time. I'd love to make sure we're remaining close in touch. And yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, that's great.
Jackie, what you got?
I think similarly, like now is not to cut, when times of uncertainty is not the time to cut your DEIB or DEBI or whatever you want to put, all the things that, because you forget, like it's not just about hiring people from underrepresented backgrounds. It's about everyone belonging and feeling included during this time of uncertainty. You want people to feel like they belong right now. The people who may have weathered through the storm, who weren't part of the layoffs, who have survivor guilt because here we are into the holidays. So you need those people. Again, you don't want to be disruptive, understanding that you have to make financial decisions. A layoff is always disruptive, and you need someone to be able to offer that support on how can we make sure that people feel included and belonging and belong to the organization moving forward. Now is not the time to cut those roles.
Center humanity. Yeah. Just being thoughtful is the key, being incredibly thoughtful about it. You know, I often, and this will be a great point to kind of end on, but I often will share, as we were kind of touching on belonging, that it is hard for any person, regardless of their background, their demographics, but any person to show up at their best in any environment if they are always questioning whether or not they belong. Do I belong here? Am I seen? Am I valued? Am I heard? Do I have full opportunity for success? So if organizationally you want to be able to weather the storm, come out on top, you're going to want to make sure that your people feel like they can show up at their best, because if not, then you have no chance of really being able to endure some of the hardships that I know we've experienced before, back in 2008, back when the pandemic hit, you know. So take heed to this advice that we all are echoing and sharing today.
Absolutely. I think, you know, and that's kind of where I was going to go, is we're now in that crunch time. So as an HR person, I've always been, you don't do layoffs between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And I know that, again, a lot of organizations are in, what are we going to do for next year? How are we preparing for next year? But please just don't. That would be one piece. And then I think the other piece is we are entering that holiday time frame. And so making sure you have mental health services, making sure you have support for all of your team members. We have no idea what the circumstances are of their family situations or whatever it might be, how they will get through the holidays. We just, a dear friend of ours lost their brother last year, and you know, she's looking at the holidays and is like, I don't know how I'm going to do this. Like, I want to just go to bed until January 1st and not think about it. And making sure that you're just being thoughtful about that and making sure you're really supporting your folks in this time. And every time, I mean, I think back to what you just said, and you get like, at all times, being supportive of your team and making sure they're okay.
Mm-hmm. At all times. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. On that note, Dr. Anika White, thank you so much for joining us. You are a rock star. We get to the pleasure of having amazing speakers. And so we will definitely be having you back on and appreciate you taking the time. This is awesome. And I'm sure our listeners will really enjoy this. So this is Katie Van Horn.
And this is Jackie Clayton.
Bye.
Bye.
You might be surprised to know that not all serial killers are straight, cisgender white men. And the victims of true crime are not a monolith either. She's Wendy and I'm Beth, and together we host Fruit Loop's Serial Killers of Color, a true crime podcast.
Together we take deep dives into the true crime stories about marginalized and minoritized perps and victims that often go untold.
We also provide the context and nuance that these stories deserve. At Fruit Loops, we're serving up true crime with a side of history, society, culture, and some fun.
Listen to Fruit Loop Serial Killers of Color on Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.